Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The healthcare ruling still isn't out, but people are getting ready. What do animated animals and allergies have in common? Wait till you hear that one. And a walk down the street of eternal happiness. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 21st of June. Good to have you with us. All right, Monday, that's going to be the day, or maybe next Thursday. We don't really know yet. Someday, though, the Supreme Court is going to hand down its ruling on the healthcare law. And with the amount of money that's on the line with that case for lobbying groups and healthcare companies and insurance firms, time is a waste. And time literally is money. Anna Palmer covers money and politics for Politico. Anna, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
This is one of those stories that it's like hanging out there. We know it's coming, and so everybody's got plenty of time to get ready. You've been making the rounds in Washington of the lobbying groups, healthcare, pharmaceuticals, you name it. What are they doing? How are they getting themselves set?
Everybody has waiting with bated breath, that much is for sure. You know, there's a lot of planning that goes into what these associations, trade groups, companies are going to say publicly, because they don't want to cause a firestorm by saying the wrong thing and getting into trouble with Democrats or Republicans.
Yeah, you know what it reminds me of is, I don't know if you remember the night of Bush v. Gore at the Supreme Court and people standing there live on the air reading this thing and then having to go back and saying, oh, no, that's not exactly what it says.
Absolutely. You know, I talked to a lot of lobbyists and law firms, and what they're doing is, I mean, they have SWAT teams that they're bringing in to read everything very, very carefully. And the analogy to Gore v. Bush has come up quite a bit.
And they're doing this in the name, I would imagine, of client service, right? They're gonna get all this information, put it together, and then get the word out to their constituent groups.
Absolutely. I mean, this is why they get paid the big bucks. So they're going to be sending out as soon as possible. I mean, one firm said, you know, within milliseconds, they're going to have the ability to tell their clients what the decision will mean for them.
So the name of the game in lobbying is to eventually get legislation in your favor. I would point to the calendar, though, and mention that we're not going to get any legislation between now and the end of the year because there's this election thing coming up. What's the timeline for these guys?
It's definitely becoming silly season here where not a lot of real legislating is going to go on. But I think even after the election, most of the healthcare industry is really looking to 2013. Anything that's going to happen, you know, before the election or really in that lame duck period is going to be messaging bills, is going to be making sure that nothing that is going to be destructive to the industry goes forward.
Anna Palmer, she's the money and politics reporter at Politico. Anna, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Speaking of stories everybody knew was coming, did you hear the one about Moody's? All day long, there were rumors the ratings agency was going to downgrade a whole slew of banks after the close on Wall Street. Finally happened about an hour and a half or so after the bell. But mere rumor was enough to derail the day's trading. The major indices had their second worst session of the year. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. From the Marketplace desk of what could possibly go wrong comes this today, a partnership between Merck, the pharmaceutical company, and DreamWorks, the movie studio. There is, of course, nothing new about studios pairing up to capitalize on a new movie they've got coming out. In this case, Madagascar 3. Usually it's Happy Meal toys, though, or pajamas or something. This time, it's allergy medicine. Merck is going to market Claritin, using the neurotic giraffe and insecure lion and the whole rest of that gang from that film. Marketplace's Sally Herships has the story.
Have you seen Madagascar 3? There are talking animals and a bear in a pink tutu with a tricycle and a bow on her head. You can buy Madagascar penguin-shaped gummies, or you can get Claritin. The kid's allergy medication now comes with animals from the movie on its box.
It basically creates the impression that it's candy.
Kara Wilking is a lawyer with the Public Health Advocacy Institute. She says all the zebras, lions, and penguins on the Claritin packaging could confuse kids, and that's dangerous.
Kids' requests for medicine should be based on how they're feeling and not on sophisticated marketing campaigns.
And Wilking says it's wrong to market over-the-counter drugs to children. So she helped draft a complaint to the FTC. DreamWorks, which made Madagascar, wouldn't comment. And Merck, the company that makes Claritin, didn't respond to requests for comment. But Merck is highly profitable. For now. Tom O'Connor advises healthcare companies on mergers. He says the whole industry is nervous about the future.
And it takes them 15 years and multi-billion dollars to get an entity from molecule to on the shelf.
And then their patents run out. So pharmaceutical companies are looking to leverage drugs they already have and for new ways to connect with consumers, like a Madagascar activity guide on Claritin's Facebook page. Patty Williams teaches marketing at Wharton.
They're just trying to find their way to these sorts of cutting-edge techniques, just like every company is. It's just that within pharma, it's fraught with a little bit more risk.
So Merck may have to turn to its own anti-anxiety medicine while the FTC reviews the case. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Okay, wrap your head around this one if you can. A couple of weeks ago, the OECD, that's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, issued a report that said more than half of American companies are having trouble finding enough skilled workers to hire. That's with 8.2% unemployment, by the way. We're doing worse than Germany and China, England and Canada. And get this, the skills gap, as it's known, has actually grown in the past 5 years. That's in spite of more people looking for work and ever more Americans walking around with college degrees and trade school certificates. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
Where you hear about the skills gap most is in high-end manufacturing.
This is one of our CNC multi-axis lathes.
The kind of factory where the floors are squeaky clean and the machines are run by computer.
We have job openings. The people are not trained for the jobs that are open today.
That's Darlene Miller, who runs Permac Industries. It's an aerospace and medical device manufacturer outside Minneapolis. In Reading, Pennsylvania, Elaine McDevitt's Rose Corporation is about the same size, 50 employees. They make precision machine parts.
10 years ago, it was a lot easier to find welders with a lot of skill, not just a welder that said he was a welder, but welders that could do the type of welding we need. People are coming out of school not with the math skills that they used to.
Gardner Carrick at the Manufacturing Institute has the numbers on this for 2011.
Over 80% of manufacturers were having a moderate or serious shortage of skilled production workers. Over 600,000 jobs were open in manufacturing because companies were unable to find qualified applicants.
Really? With so many Americans looking for work? Many of them middle-aged. Presumably they got a decent education back when such a thing was possible.
I think a lot of employers are just being irrational about this.
Management professor Peter Capelli at the Wharton School is what I call the big skeptic on the so-called skills gap.
If employers really are willing to leave a position open for months and months while they keep searching, rather than spend a week or so training somebody, they're doing something wrong.
Basically, Capelli thinks employers are just being cheap. He says this is something they learned from the downsizing of the 1980s. It was so easy to snap up laid-off workers somebody else had already trained. So then companies downsized their own training programs to save money. Meanwhile, they've steadily raised the bar on job applicants, demanding ever more credentials and work experience, then complain they can't find good help.
This is sort of like saying, my pants don't fit anymore. The problem, I believe, is that the fabric is shrinking.
It's a clever analogy, but I think that in some regards it misses the point.
Again, Gardner Carrick of the Manufacturing Institute.
Nobody expects a hospital to take someone just out of high school or just out of college and train them to be a nurse or a doctor. Why is it that manufacturing are the ones that are expected to do all the training of their workers on their own?
It should be easy enough to check whether the amount of time and money companies spend training their workers has fallen, except no one tracks this comprehensively. The best estimate comes from the American Society for Training and Development. It finds spending per employee has been essentially flat for a decade, even as the skills required by new technology in the workplace have gone up. So let's get back to the employers we started with, the ones with job openings they can't fill for skilled workers they can't find.
Yeah, they got the parts turned, pick it up, and then do a trial pattern.
Darlene Miller of Permac Industries says she's committed to training, but new hires need machinist experience and advanced math first.
We need people who can come in and be value-added the day they start.
And she's guilty of the sin Peter Capelli talked about, holding out. She searched 2 years for a machinist to run a new shift at the plant. She says it was worth the wait to avoid costly mistakes. Elaine McDevitt in Reading, Pennsylvania, wishes she could do more to train people up.
Now the marketplace is so competitive. The margins are just so tight. So maybe when we say we can't find experienced people, it's because we don't have the monetary resources to put into training from scratch like we used to.
And which employees do companies provide with the most skills enhancement? Well, according to the training organization's data, it's not production workers or customer service reps or new employees. It's supervisors, managers, and executives. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The European debt crisis is, to a certain extent, Germany versus Greece. As it happens, there's an arguably bigger matchup between the two tomorrow. They will meet in the quarterfinals of the European Football Championship, Euro 2012, it's called. It's irony and global economics all wrapped up in one.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
So today, the sporting edition of What's Up, Europe. Joseph Dweck from Bloomberg is in Frankfurt. John Siropoulos is in Athens. He writes for the New Athenian magazine. Gentlemen, good to have you here.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
So, John, let me ask you the first question. What's more in the headlines there today, the economy or football, soccer?
Well, today it's mostly about politics, the formation of the new government, which was just named this evening.
No football at all, really?
No, football is very much in people's minds. If you talk to anyone about the Greece-Germany match, everyone has an opinion. But the general consensus is that Germany is a superior team. We are, in many ways, lucky / intimidated to be playing them. Some people say that we don't stand a chance, it'll be 4-0. And some people say that if the Germans rub us up the wrong way, we might play extremely well and even win this, perhaps.
Joseph Dweck in Frankfurt, do you buy that at all?
Well, I'm not quite so sure about this, but we'll see what happens on Friday. But to be honest, tomorrow's game has not made it to the front pages of the German newspapers today. The hot topic has been Greece, nevertheless. It has been Spain and Europe's sovereign debt crisis. There is nevertheless one exception. There's the Bild-Zeitung, Germany's biggest tabloid, who wrote an article on the hotel the Greek players are staying in Poland. And the paper praises the Greeks with a slightly cynical tone for having chosen only a 4-star hotel, which charges only 93 euros per night.
Wasn't there some cartoon over there that showed the Greek players with their jerseys sponsored by Germany or something?
Well, the Greek jerseys are sponsored by Adidas, which is a German company.
Yeah.
And it is true that some have made a comment that Greece was playing against its biggest sponsor tomorrow.
John, you're going to take that?
That's not really so much the equivalence that's being seen. More, it's, I think the match is viewed as a way for Greek-German tensions to play out, at least in people's imaginations.
Mm. All right, so Joseph, put your money where your mouth is. Who's going to win? Seriously.
Well, that's a difficult question. well, if you look at it through the prism of justice, there are two responses. The just result would probably be if the best team wins, and the Germans have been doing very well. And if you take into account the macroeconomic picture, it would probably be good if the Greeks win, because their economy really needs a boost, and the victory against Germany might do it.
For a little morale. All right, John, same question to you, quickly.
Well, I think that's very generous of Joseph, emotionally. I think that clearly, as somebody put it to me, let me put it this way, Greece can only win. If Greece wins the match, of course, it's a triumph. If Greece loses the match, it loses against an adversary that it can be proud to lose to, but also that it is beholden to in many emotional and political ways.
Yeah. John Siropoulos in Athens, Joseph Dweck for Bloomberg. In Frankfurt, Germany. Guys, thanks a lot. Enjoy the game.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Coming up, going door to door on Shanghai's Street of Eternal Happiness. But first, let's do the numbers. All right. right. Yeah, so this happened. The Dow Industrials plunged 250 points today, about 2%, 12,573 is where it landed. The NASDAQ scrolled down 71 points, nearly 2.5%, 2859. The S&P 500 down 30 points, 2.25%, 1325 at the bell. Crude oil fell to under $80 a barrel. ExxonMobil, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips all drained more than 3%. So you can probably guess what the Moody's news did to financial shares. Bank of America fell nearly 4%. Citigroup withdrew 3.5%. Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase unloaded more than 2.5% apiece. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.62%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The National Council for Research on Women concludes its annual conference in Washington. Some people will stop pulling up to the pump. Tesla Motors is scheduled to begin delivering its new electric Model S sedan to customers. And she portrayed the Bionic Woman. Actress Lindsay Wagner turns 63. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Romney campaign stopped in Orlando, Florida today. Governor Romney spoke to a group of Latino government officials about immigration. President Obama takes his turn tomorrow. The speeches come, of course, on the heels of the White House announcement last week. No more deportations of otherwise law-abiding illegal immigrants who were brought here as children.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. He's here every week for an attitude check, what Americans think about the news of the moment. Frank, it's good to have you back.
Good to be with you.
So what do we know about how Americans feel about the president's decision last week on immigration?
Now, all the available evidence shows that a majority of Americans support the idea of not deporting these young people if they meet those qualifications.
Do Americans differ on how they regard the two facets of immigration, by which I mean stopping the flow of illegal immigrants versus finding a solution for those illegal immigrants already here?
Yeah, they sure do, and that's changed. Historically, we've given Americans a trade-off between the two, and always stopping the flow of immigrants coming in has been number one. But this year, we found a flip. I think that's probably because the inflow of illegal immigrants has slowed down.
Right.
So now, all of a sudden, we find, Kai, the majority of Americans saying the most important concern is dealing with illegal immigrants here in the country. And, of course, that's part of what the Obama administration announcement last week dealt with.
Right. This has become inevitably political. The president and Governor Romney are giving—
That's shocking.
Yeah, I know. They are giving competing speeches today to a large Latino group. My question, though, is does it play politically? Is it, apart from the politics of it, a political issue, if that makes any sense, right? Because you'd think that the president's going after the Latino vote with this, but my guess would be he already polls pretty well with Latinos.
He does. I think a lot of the concern on the part of his campaign team is motivation and turnout. So the announcement kind of helps solidify him, at least they hope.
To get the Latinos out to the ballot box, right?
That's absolutely right.
Immigration as an issue for Americans overall is probably like, what, 997th or something?
998th.
Yeah. Right.
We recently said to Obama voters, why are you supporting him? To Romney voters, why are you supporting him? Immigration just doesn't show up at all. It's not an important issue overall. And some of our research shows even among Hispanics who are registered voters, immigration is actually no more important than a lot of the same economic concerns that affect everybody else.
One more question, Frank, and it's a little bit out of left field. What do you know about how Americans feel about cussing?
We've asked almost every question under the sun since we started in 1935 here at Gallup, but to my knowledge, I'm not sure we've ever asked people whether or not they approve of cussing. I guess that's a fascinating question, and I have no idea.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. If you want to know more about our partnership, we call it Attitude Check, by the way. You can check our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, we'll talk to you next week.
I'll look forward to it.
I asked about the cussing, in case you're curious, because this morning the Supreme Court overruled the Federal Communications Commission on a bunch of nudity and profanity cases. Not about the actual nudity and profanity, just that the FCC basically didn't do the paperwork right. When a place changes as fast as China's been changing the past 20 or 30 years, and at the scale that China is changing, it poses a problem for reporters. How do you tell that story best? Do you do it day by day, each and every twist and turn, or do you take the long view? Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz is going with option B, and he's doing it by taking a walk down a street near his office in Shanghai called the Street of Eternal Happiness. Once a month for the next year, we'll hear the story of China's change through the people who make their living on the street known in Chinese as Changlelu, starting with a guy who's been there for a long, long time. Here's Rob.
On the Street of Eternal Happiness, number 217, there's an old man named Master Chu Hongsheng. He's 94 years old, slicked back white hair, immaculately dressed, and he's wearing a tape measure around his neck. He's a tailor, and he sells his clothes at this tiny shop. For nearly 80 years, Master Chu's made only one style of dress, the qipao. It's also known as the chengsam. If you've ever been to an upscale Chinese restaurant, you've probably seen a host or a waitress wear a qipao. It's a tight, form-fitting one-piece dress, usually embroidered with flowers. Back in the days before China was communist, most women wore qipaos. Master Chu started making them in 1934. He was 16. Back then, the Street of Eternal Happiness was named Rue Bojia, after a prominent French lawyer who lived in the city. It was a crazy time in Shanghai. The city was one of the wealthiest in the world, the Paris of the Orient. Rich foreigners mixed with Chinese in a lawless landscape. 1930s Shanghai was notorious for every kind of vice. The sexy look of a qipao was a perfect fit. And that meant business was booming for Master Chu.
It was different back then. We didn't even have cars. People pulled you around in a rickshaw. If you were wealthy, you had a carriage. The qipao was really part of our national dress. Whether you were a rich or a poor girl, you wore one. Girls who went to the dance halls wore very tight ones. I thought they were a little too tight.
But that didn't stop Master Chu from making them. What nearly stopped him, though, were the anti-capitalist campaigns of Chairman Mao Zedong's communist China. In the late 1960s, Mao initiated China's Cultural Revolution, calling for class struggle, putting the economy at a standstill. The government outlawed qipaos, calling them a symbol of bourgeois decadence. By then, Master Chu had decades of experience. He was known as one of the best qipao tailors in the country. Instead of targeting him for this, government officials made calls to him on the sly. Now that qipaos were taboo, officials' wives, it turned out, wanted these symbols of bourgeois decadence more than ever.
During the Cultural Revolution, government officials would send their cars late in the evening to pick me up, and then they'd drop me off at a hotel where I'd make qipaos for their wives.
Not even Chairman Mao could stand in the way of Master Chu's business, nor can today's rapidly changing China. The manager of Master Chu's store, Fu Xinglin, removes bright red and white qipaos from a rack. It's wedding season in Shanghai, high season for qipaos. Business, he says, has never been better for Han Yi, the brand name of his and Master Chu's qipao line.
We used to sell more qipaos overseas, but not since the financial crisis in the West. Nowadays, demand in China is very strong. And that's great because foreign buyers used to think $1,000 for a qipao was too much. These days, the Chinese will come and buy qipaos that cost more than $5,000.
In fact, the most expensive qipaos here cost more than $10,000. Customer Fan Haiyin and her husband took a five-hour flight from across China just to buy one. But in her conversation with the clerk, she can't decide which one.
Do you have a white one? I like red, too.
Well, red is China's classic color. You can wear it at a wedding or if you're hosting an event.
I just can't decide.
Just choose the red one and the white one.
And that equals more money for Master Chu.
Business has picked up ever since Deng Xiaoping opened up China 30 years ago. There's more trade now. China has transformed itself.
It's Today's economic boom in Shanghai reminds Master Chu of the golden days of the Qipao, when business never seemed to stop. He's not stopping either. Later this year, he'll become a great-great-grandfather. He says he still won't retire. Ask him if he has a secret for living so long. Be your own boss, he says, and make sure to always hang out with younger people. Should be easy enough for a 94-year-old tailor here on the Street of Eternal Happiness. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We've got a video of Rob riding his bike down the Street of Eternal Happiness in Shanghai. It's on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a moment to remember economist Anna Schwartz, who died today at the age of 96. 50 years ago or so, she wrote a book with Milton Friedman, who went on to win the Nobel Prize, called A Monetary History of the United States, that Ben Bernanke said is the best explanation there is of the causes of the Great Depression. When we had her on the program 3 years ago, though, to talk about the Fed's response to the Great Recession and Mr. Bernanke, Dr. Schwartz did not return the favor.
Considering Bernanke's background, you would have expected a much more, well, should I say, a tidy kind of performance by the Federal Reserve.
Of course, she didn't care much for Alan Greenspan either.
Well, I think the verdict of history will be different with regard to his stature than it has been so far.
Anna Schwartz, she died today. She was 96. Got her PhD in economics, by the way, at the age of 48. You can hear the whole interview with her on our website. It's marketplace.org. Today, the Dow plunged 251 points, about 2%, ended things at 12,573. The NASDAQ off 71 points, nearly 2.5%, 2859. The S&P 500 off 30 points, 2.25%, 1325 is the number you're looking for there. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.